Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kochański, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 14th of June. We have come to the end of the little theological season which follows Pentecost. The final day of it was Saturday the 13th, the Immaculate Heart of Mary. Now we are back in the routine of ordinary time, and it will carry on week after week like this until the end of the Church's year in November. As if to emphasise the ordinariness of ordinary time, this week we don't even have major saints' days to interrupt the steady flow. But that doesn't mean there's nothing to say. There are a couple of saints well worth remembering, even though we don't actually celebrate them because their feast day is on Sunday this year. There are two important anniversaries to talk about too, including one which I forgot entirely until someone reminded me of it. As for the Liturgy of the Hours itself, by now I've talked about each of the hours in the day, but there are some details that are worth filling in, and they have some rather human stories attached. It is easy to slip into thinking that the Church is just an institution, but it isn't at all, it is people. And in the history of the liturgy, between agreeing something ought to be done and deciding this is what we shall do, there are some great stories of expert, sincere and devoted people arguing things through with a shared purpose and reaching a conclusion. Or not quite reaching a conclusion, as you'll see. First of all, talking about this particular week, the 11th week in ordinary time, flowing steadily without interruptions, is a very good time to mention one of the pages in Universalis which is not an hour. The page is called Spiritual Reading, which is the most uninteresting name I could think of at the time. You can find it in all the Universalis apps and programs. The Spiritual Reading page is what it says, Spiritual Reading. It goes to the Office of Readings and takes just the second reading, which is the reading which is not from Scripture. These are the readings which made me fall in love with the Liturgy of the Hours in the first place. Having this reading on its own means that you can read it even when you don't have the energy or the time or the concentration for the sustained holiness that a whole hour seems to deserve. This week, each day's spiritual reading page has a passage from St. Cyprian's treatise on the Lord's Prayer. St. Cyprian lived in Carthage in North Africa in the 3rd century, at a time when the Church was sometimes barely tolerated and sometimes actively persecuted, but that did not stop him writing some excellent letters and treatises, clear and simple and wise, and it is good to be able to find them here in the liturgy. As for this week's subject, the Lord's Prayer is so familiar to us all that we can recite it without thinking, in our sleep practically. It becomes automatic, like those dolls you used to be able to buy, where you pulled a string and when you let go the doll would make a sound like Mama. We need to get the meaning back into the familiar words, and when St. Cyprian explains the Lord's Prayer to us one line each day, that is exactly what we get. We wake up and we see the meaning. If that were all the spiritual reading page did, it would be a good thing, but it would be nothing to write home about. The spiritual reading page is splendid because it gives readings for the feasts we don't celebrate as well as for the ones we do. What I mean is this. This week, on Tuesday the 16th, England celebrates St. Richard of Chichester, who was Bishop of Chichester in the 13th century and a great and much-loved man. Nobody outside England, following the liturgy, will even know that he existed, but the reading for his feast is charming and inspiring and tells us all about him. The spiritual reading page includes it. The same goes for Wednesday, where St. Botolf is remembered nowhere except East Anglia. On Friday, St. Romuald can be celebrated anywhere in the world, but only optionally. Still, spiritual reading will always give you a reading for him. On Saturday, St. Alban, the first martyr of England, isn't remembered anywhere except England, but in the spiritual reading page, everyone across the world can see what the Venerable Bede had to say about him in his Ecclesiastical History of the English People. It all sounds rather like a newspaper, and it is, except that everything in it is true and worth reading. Reading the spiritual reading page is always new and always refreshing. It's a good habit to have. I said there are a couple of saints whose feasts fell on this Sunday so that they aren't actually celebrated, but they are still worth remembering. The first of these is Saint Lidwina, who is a Dutch saint, and I only discovered her existence when someone asked me to add the calendar of the Netherlands to Universalis, and there she was. I'm always learning new things in that kind of way. Lidwina was born in 1380. At the age of 15, she was out ice skating, and she fell and broke her rib, and the wound never healed. A disease spread through her body. By 19, she had lost the use of her legs. As time went on, she got worse, until in the end she could move nothing except her left hand. She was in constant pain. But she had a wonderful gift of prayer and contemplation, and even though she herself could not be healed, she had the power to heal others. You may remember that it was said of someone else, "He saves others, he cannot save himself." A few people thought that Lidwina's healing power must come from the devil, but many holy men saw her and they revered her. In deep contemplation on Easter Day, 1433, she was given a vision of Christ coming towards her to administer the sacrament of extreme unction, and 2 days later she died. Her grave became a place of pilgrimage, and veneration of her grew and grew through the centuries. Finally, Pope Leo XIII canonized her in 1890. I knew a doctor who loved reading accounts of diseases far back in history and trying to work out what, now, the diagnosis would be. There are enough details in the biographies of Lidwina to show that she suffered from a form of multiple sclerosis, centuries before anyone even gave that disease a name. Lidwina is celebrated in just one country, Holland. The other saint of Sunday is celebrated by just one religious order, the Carmelites. He is Saint Elisha. Yes, the prophet Elisha from the 9th century BC, and the Carmelites celebrate him as a saint. The church is very shy indeed about canonizing non-Christian saints, but the Carmelites aren't shy about Elisha at all. They added him to their calendar in 1399, so heaven help anyone who tries to stop them now. And yes, the spiritual reading page for this Sunday, apart from its instalment of St. Cyprian on the Lord's Prayer, also has a sermon of St. Ambrose about the prophet Elisha and why he matters so much. I promised you a couple of anniversaries. Sunday is the 14th. We are halfway through June already, which is a horrid thought, and on the 14th of June 1936, exactly 90 years ago, there died the writer and journalist G.K. Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton is one of those people you come to know so well that when someone asks you, "Who was he?" it is hard to know where to start. Everything you think of saying is true in itself, but also false because it isn't the whole truth. You don't know where to begin. To tell the true story, you would need to begin everywhere at once. I first encountered Chesterton when I was 10 and someone gave me an anthology of his work. It knocked me flat, and to some extent Chesterton has coloured the way I think from that day to this. He was born in 1874 in London to a respectable and comfortable middle-class family. It was the height of the comfortable, successful era of late Victorianism, where everything was right, we were all right, and we had outgrown such medieval survivals as religion. We lived in a sort of pure vacuum of respectable enlightenment. Jesus Christ was an admirable ethical teacher, and from time to time we would go to church to show that we approved of him. It was a vacuum, and man cannot breathe a vacuum, however pure and enlightened it is, or eat it, or live in it. By the 1890s, some people had discovered an answer which was no answer, despair and decadence. Full of the fear of nothing, some of them pursued evil specifically for itself, because at least evil was not nothing. This was the time Chesterton grew up in, but he was protected by God. From his childhood he had a strong sense of the goodness of everything. At a time when people were, it seemed, tired of living at all, he felt strongly, overwhelmingly, the goodness of existence itself. in one of his earliest poems, An Unborn Child, speaks. If trees were tall and grass were short, as in some crazy tale, if here and there a sea were blue beyond the breaking pale, if a fixed fire hung in the air to warm me all day through, if deep green hair grew on great hills, I know what I should do. I think that if they gave me leave within the world to stand, I would be good through all the day I spent in fairyland. They should not hear a word from me of selfishness or scorn, if only I could find the door, if only I were born. Now, to such grace and innocence, the devil is greatly attracted. Not only is it fun attacking the grace and corrupting the innocence, if he can manage that, the rest of us ordinary people will be easy to take. And so the devil came to Chesterton and attacked him. Throughout his time at art school, he was besieged by horrible visions of evil and degradation. But the innocence of Chesterton came from the core of his being, because that was where God had put it, and it stood up to it all. Chesterton escaped, or was rescued. Whichever it was, he thought about it because he always thought. He was that sort of person. When he was a schoolboy, he thought so intensely he never noticed what was happening around him. Once, as an experiment, his friends filled his pockets with snow, and back in the classroom it melted and cold water dripped down his legs. But he was thinking too hard to notice he was getting wet. What Chesterton started to think about was this. He knew about the goodness of things. He knew about the joy of existence. He wanted to make sense of all that. Everyone in that enlightened time knew there was no religion left alive that had anything to say about these things, so he invented his own. And when he had finished inventing it, he found that he had invented Christianity. Here is how he puts it. I am the fool of this story, and no rebel shall hurl me from that throne. I tried to be 10 minutes in advance of the truth, but I found that I was 1800 years behind it. I strained my voice with a painfully juvenile exaggeration in uttering my truths, and I was punished in the fittest and funniest way, because I discovered not that they were not truths, but that they were not mine. When I fancied that I stood alone, I was really in the ridiculous position of being backed up by all Christendom. Chesterton's enlightenment and conversion did not happen as it might happen to you or me because someone taught him. It happened because he thought it. It came not from outside, but from inside. And because his whole thought came from inside like that, he saw other people from inside too, from their inside. In Chesterton's detective stories, his hero, Father Brown, solves crimes by seeing from the inside what it must be like to be the criminal. After that, having himself become the criminal, so to speak, he only has to look at the people round him to see who the actual criminal really was. He describes it somewhere as a kind of religious exercise, originally from Pope Leo XIII. He says, "You think a crime horrible because you could never commit it. I think it is horrible because I could commit it." It gives you your remorse beforehand. Why this matters is not because it makes for good detective stories, although it does. It matters because Chesterton, as a matter of duty, took part in all the major controversies of the age. To take one example, the poor seemed to have nothing but a choice between starvation and enslavement by the rich. Socialists, like George Bernard Shaw, thought that the poor should be saved by socialism, that is, by making them slaves of the state. In other words, from people not being able to have a house because the rich people owned them all, you go to nobody at all being allowed to have their own house, rich or poor. Chesterton argued that there was another way. Instead of being either slaves of the rich or slaves of the officials of the state, people should be given their freedom. The first third of the 20th century was full of arguments like this, arguments about real things, things that mattered. There was revolution always in the air, off stage. Sometimes it nearly arrived on stage as well. Chesterton argued for God and freedom, Shaw argued for atheism and socialism, and there were several others, Hilaire Belloc, H. G. Wells, and more, who argued as well. They fought it all out in front of huge audiences. But one thing about Chesterton's battles was that he fought them from the inside. In order to refute Shaw, he got into Shaw's head. He tried to think the way Shaw thought, so that he could see what was making him say the wrong-headed things he was saying. He loved Shaw, and he wanted Shaw to achieve success by being convinced and agreeing with him. And so it was with all his controversies. You might compare that with things now. When someone doesn't believe exactly what I believe, I do not try to persuade him. I do not even say that he is wrong. I say he is unclean. I say to everyone, do not go near this leper. Find out what sweet shop he gets his sweets from and tell everyone not to go there. Unclean, unclean. Compare this with Chesterton and Shaw, who loved one another even when they were fighting, especially when they were fighting. An interviewer once said to Chesterton, Shaw may be wrong, but at least he has his heart in the right place. No, said Chesterton. Shaw has a heart as big as a house, but it is in the wrong place. We are told that we need to love our enemies. This is one way to do it. I mentioned St. Thomas Aquinas last week in connection with the Feast of Corpus Christi. This fits well for a final illustration of Chesterton's thought, or lack of thought. One day a publisher suggested that a book about St. Thomas might sell well as a companion to Chesterton's book about St. Francis of Assisi. By the way, you can read that one in Universalis. His secretary was terrified. St. Thomas was the ultimate scholar, studying his sources, tabulating his themes, structuring his arguments. Chesterton was the ultimate non-scholar, flicking through a book too fast to read it, or holding it in his hand for hours while he thought about something. A biography of the scholar by the non-scholar would surely be a disaster. The writing process was every bit as frightening as she had feared. Chesterton dictated very rapidly about half the book. Then he said, I want you to go to London and get me some books. What books? She asked. He said, I don't know. Anyway, she got him some books about St. Thomas Aquinas, and he flipped rapidly through them and drew a picture of St. Thomas in the margin of one of them. Then he dictated, very rapidly, the second half of his book. The book was published, and here is what Etienne Gilson, the greatest Aquinas scholar of his day, had to say about it. Chesterton makes one despair. I have been studying St. Thomas all my life, and I could never have written such a book. He has guessed all that we scholars have tried to demonstrate. He has said all that we have more or less clumsily been attempting to express in academic terms. Chesterton was one of the deepest thinkers who existed. He was deep because he was right, and he could not help being right. The moral of that story is that wisdom does not belong only to clever, studious, and systematic thinkers. It belongs to everyone, each in their own way, even if they never study, if they only live and see. I hope that all this has encouraged you to go and read Chesterton. He died long enough ago that everything he wrote can be found online. Or if you think that books should exist, and bookshops should survive, and you believe in the power inherent in material things, buy some actual books. I suggest starting with The Man Who Was Thursday, which pretends to be a thriller but is something more, or the Father Brown stories, or his autobiography. You can find links to all of these in the podcast notes. I said two anniversaries. The other anniversary was actually last week, but I never noticed and someone had to write in to remind me. 30 years ago, last Tuesday, it was the 9th of June 1996. 9-6-96, which is rather decorative, and it was the day on which Universalis started. Note, I don't say, I started Universalis. Without too much exaggeration, I could really say Universalis started me. What I did, I only did because it seemed like a good idea at the time, no more than that. But one thing followed another, and Universalis grew, not because of a grand plan of mine, but because each step, when the time came, seemed the logical step to take. Now Universalis touches tens of thousands of lives daily, and I happen to know it has saved some. It has turned my own life upside down, and standing back, I see how subtle God is, and how he rides each soul like a horse, the way that particular horse, that particular soul, needs to be ridden. Because if he said to me, "Here's a 30-year plan," I would have shied away, the way a horse does when you drag it forwards by the bridle. I'd have become scared or overawed. So instead, the still small voice said, "Why not do this?" and nothing more. Once that "this" was completed, there was another "this," and so it went on. I don't know how God speaks to you, loudly or softly. I don't know if he shows you a whole future laid out like a map, or whether he leads you one step at a time into the welcoming mist. But I can say that while you are weaving the pattern he wants you to weave, you won't necessarily see it often, or see it at all. Have faith. There is a pattern, and one day you will see it. Now for the Liturgy of the Hours. You will have noticed that it is full of psalms. 3 psalms for each hour, once you allow for some of the psalms being too long and having to be cut into smaller pieces. When you are alert and alive and hungry for it, this is wonderful nutrition. When you are worn down by the routine of life and the familiarity of the liturgy, 3 psalms comes to mean psalm after psalm after psalm. Instead of saying brightly, "Hooray, here comes another way to sing to God," you say, "Oh no, not another one." When the psalmist says, as he does say somewhere, "I will sing for ever of your mercies, Lord," your heart sinks because you know forever really does mean forever. There is another, more fundamental problem with the Psalms. The Psalms are not Christian. As Christians, you might think of us as neo-Jews, but the Jews were never proto-Christians. The Psalms are Jewish and nothing else. Already in the 5th century, people were thinking that something needed to be done about this. They decided to end each psalm with "Glory be to the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit," as indeed we still do. They also wrote prayers to put at the end of the psalms so as to pull the threads together and set each psalm in its Christian context. The prayers would have Christian themes that grew out of the psalms themselves, the Incarnation, the Redemption, the Resurrection, the Trinity, and so on. Because these prayers collected together the themes of a psalm, they were called collects. The collects were widely used, but after a couple of centuries they faded from view. I suspect that the Liturgy of the Hours was so very long, 12 psalms before breakfast, that anything that made it even longer was just too much. Best make the burden as light as we can, people thought, and so the collects evaporated. Over the next 1,000 years, the Church tried to reform the Liturgy of the Hours more than once, but the work was too big and too hard, and somehow it always ran into the sand and nothing came of it. Finally, in the 1960s, it did get done. One change was that the sheer burden of the Psalms was lightened considerably, and so someone thought of asking, "We have room to breathe now, so what about reviving those collects?" Accordingly, in 1964, a group of interested and expert people was put together to consider the question. The group included the Benedictine scholar who had been studying all the various ancient texts of these collects in great detail. A collection of sample prayers was put together so that people could go away and try them. They did, and the results were interesting and diverse. One cardinal thought they were a bad idea, full stop. He couldn't stop people studying these things as literature if they wanted to, but they shouldn't use them. Another committee member said, "Don't close the door to people who feel the need to break the monotony of the Psalms." Someone else said, "We could put them in a separate volume, so that people can use them at home without disturbing the public liturgy. What ended up happening was that these prayers, now called psalm prayers rather than collects, were described in the introduction to the Liturgy of the Hours, but not printed in the books. The psalm prayers were promised for a supplementary volume. 50 years later, that supplementary volume hasn't quite got round to being published, but let's not be impatient. What is half a century, after all? From somewhere, an Italian translation bubbled up. A Polish translation somehow appeared. The Americans got hold of a version, heaven knows how, and put it in their books. The English kept a straight bat and played by the official rules, so in their books there are no psalm prayers. What are we, the people, to do? You must use the psalm prayers if you want to, and you must not use the psalm prayers if you do not want to. A lot of the worry of the committees was actually about how to say this in a book. However much you label things as optional or say, we are offering this to you in case it helps, there are people who revere the printed words so much that whatever is written down, they feel they have to do it. Here is where the electronic nature of Universalis makes everything easier. You decide early on whether you want the psalm prayers or not. Don't worry, you can change your choice later if you want to. If you say you want the psalm prayers, you will see them in the right place. If you say you don't want the psalm prayers, you won't need to skip them the way you would in a book. You just won't see them at all. The psalm prayers are available in English in Universalis, and also in Latin, because thanks to the kindness of someone, I'm not sure who, we were given them in Latin as well as English. It is splendid Latin as well, the good, proper, classical language, far different from the utility Latin in which most of the liturgy is composed. I hope that story wasn't too long. I put it in because it shows how the making of the liturgy isn't magic. It's done by people. People have various views sometimes, and sometimes the end result can seem a little paradoxical if we forget that. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.